figure, it's just the Monday mornings taking a toll. So today's lecture, the topic is Kaluza-Klein theory, which is one way of having extra dimensions, but still nonetheless having something that looks like four-dimensional gravity. So, you know, why might we want to do this? Well, I was saying last week, you know, reasons for thinking about higher dimensional gravity. But I think also there's sort of three main topics I want to try and get across today. But I think one of the other reasons that it's nice to think about Kaluza-Klein theory is it's exploring different ways that we can use geometry to describe our own world. And it's not so unreasonable to imagine that when we look at space-time at very small scales, it stops looking four-dimensional. Now, you know, maybe it stops looking four-dimensional and stops looking like a manifold, you know, in some sort of intrinsically quantum way. But on the other hand, you know, it's also possible that extra degrees of freedom pop up at lower scale, smaller scales. And so trying to think about a way of describing this in a sort of pseudo-classical sense by looking at geometry of higher dimensional manifolds that somehow projects out into some four-dimensional sense, you know, is a useful thing to do. So what we're going to do today is we're going to do the sort of technical bit of dimensionally reducing. We're going to just do it in one extra dimension, as Kaluza and Klein originally did. Then there's a sort of interim piece, which is just looking at the type of four-dimensional gravity that we get. And what we'll see is there's an extra degree of freedom included in it. So this is our first concrete example of an action that goes beyond Einstein. So this is something which isn't quite Einstein gravity. And so that'll involve discussing different frames of reference. So that's something, again, that tends to come up in other contexts. And then finally, I hope to be able to get to black hole solutions in Kaluza-Klein theory so that you'll see kind of what possibilities there are. And there's actually rather a nice, very nice, elegant solution called the Kaluza-Klein monopole. We'll see if we get that far. Depends on how many questions there are. So let me just begin by doing the technical bit, reducing gravity. So here I've got a five-dimensional metric. So I'm going to take a five-dimensional geometry with just, at the moment, I guess I'm not assuming it's Einstein gravity. I will when I start talking about the gravitational action. But I'm taking my five-dimensional geometry, and I want to project it out into its four-dimensional degrees of freedom. So in this case, what Kaluza and Klein thought about was, suppose there was an extra dimension just tacked onto space, but nothing depended on it. And so with more historical hindsight, or the Klein part of it, we're going to say that extra dimension is a little circle. It's parameterized by an angle psi, and d by d psi is a killing vector, so that means nothing depends explicitly on psi in the metric. So if I want to decompose my metric into four-dimensional degrees of freedom, then obviously I've got a g psi psi, so I'm encoding that with that scalar field sigma. I could have cross terms, so I'm writing those as a four-dimensional covector. And then I've got what remains, which is mu nu, so the four-dimensional indices, a four-dimensional metric. So this is the way I'm choosing to write it. So, and the obvious reason is that in this case, root g5 is e to the sigma root g4, the four-dimensional metric. And of course, it's already tailor-made for me to use that Cartan approach to derive the curvature, which is what I need if I want to decide what is my gravitational action in four dimensions. So I'm going to try to identify my five-dimensional orthonormal basis. So obviously I'll split this one up into an orthonormal basis. And then the natural omega psi is going to be just read off. As this combination of the extra dimension and the covector. So we're just going to do the same sort of machinery that we've done before. It's a little different. I think when we did it with the domain wall, it was kind of the inverse way. There, everything depended on the extra dimension. But here, roughly speaking, what's going to happen is the four-dimensional indices are just going to talk to themselves for the most part. And then we've got the extra piece bolted on, which is the psi and the a. So when I take the exterior derivative of omega psi, I obviously, the only things that depend or have any variance in there are the scalar field sigma, so that just gives me a derivative of sigma, you know, times omega psi, and then it hits the a mu dx mu. So f there literally is just dA. So if I now try and extract, I'll stop putting the hats on, otherwise I'm bound to be inconsistent in what I remember. So when I try and infer what my connection one forms are from this exterior derivative and the Cartan's first equation, the thing that I notice is that I've got a little bit of crosstalk, because normally when we've used Cartan in the past, we've had a very clean block diagonal metric. We haven't had off-diagonal terms. So here is your first example of some off-diagonal terms. So this is when Cartan starts to get slightly less efficient, because really what you're doing is it's like a set of simultaneous algebraic equations that you're inverting to find these thetas. And so normally, if everything's block diagonal, that's totally straightforward. But here we just have to work slightly harder. So these extras here have to be there in order that d omega psi picks up this field strength F. And so we just carry on to find the curvature two forms. So as I say, in the most part, what happens within the four dimensions stays within the four dimensions. But here, this is one example where we get a little bit of crosstalk, which is this cross term coming from the extra dimension. So I simply go ahead and differentiate this spin connection term here, and then add the cross terms.
Thank you.
So the first bit, I just take the derivative of this. I've got d of theta naught, got a derivative of sigma, I've got a derivative of f, the components, the scalars, fab, and then d omega psi, which is read off from here. So that gives me the half e to the sigma f, but then this term kind of adds up with that term to give you 1. Then I've got to take the cross pieces. So that line is coming from this term, theta naught cross theta naught, plus some extra pieces involving f. And then finally, I've got to take theta a psi cross theta psi b. So the last line is going to be coming from that. Okay, so I've kind of written those down quickly because I know you've got a handout, but the gist is that here, you know, once again, it's just sort of yet another example of the application of this technique. There's a bit more going on, but it's fairly straightforward algebra. So it's a question of just substitution of those various one forms that we've calculated into our Cartan's equation. So it's there's nothing secret going on here.
Mm-hmm. Sorry for the one form theta AB. Mm-hmm. How do you get the second term in the right-hand side?
The e to the sigma FAB, yeah. So the point there is that when you, if you look at the Cartan equations, you see that d omega is equal to minus theta wedge omega. And so in that case, you know from looking at the d omega psi that you expect an f piece in the one forms involving the psi a. However, it's what's less clear, but as soon as you try and do it, you see that if you don't put that piece there, this term will contribute to d omega a. So it's simply a question of this needs to be here in order to make Cartan's first structural equation work. So in essence, if you like, d omega a is minus theta ab cross omega b minus theta a psi cross omega psi. So that's why you need it, because you can see otherwise you get that term coming in, so you need that there to cancel it. So if you look at it afterwards, it'll... So that's why it's there. So this is what happens when you've got cross terms. You can't just, you know, in this so far, when we've done these block diagonal metrics, we've been able to be fairly lazy and just pick things out directly. Here you have to just realize that what you're really doing when you find the one forms is solving a set of algebraic equations. A little bit different because they're involving forms and not numbers, but it's the same. So that's necessary to make it work. So if I just tidy that up, I just wrote it down to sort of illustrate where all those terms come from. It does look a bit long and unfriendly. But you can see that things group together. You can see that from the first term, in the first two lines, that's my just curvature 2 form of the back of the G mu nu. You can see that there's some terms involving FF. Here's one of them. There's another one up at the end. And then there's also pieces involving just here we've got an F with a essentially a connection. Here we've got derivatives of the scalar. But we can kind of group all of these together. So the FF pieces. So I just kind of grouped everything together there, and you can see that the top line, this is the four-dimensional space-time component of the two forms, and the top line is the space-time combination of the one form. So if I'm looking for what my action is, what I need to compute is the Ricci scalar. For the Ricci scalar, I need the Ricci tensor, which means that the only pieces that contribute to R, so if you remember R, I need to kind of look at components of the Riemann tensor that are either all space-time or A psi, A psi. So it's only like this first piece that I actually need. So in all those sort of extra pieces involving F are what you need in order to get that last term. So this is telling us, if I kind of look at this part here, you know, you can sort of see this kind of looks a bit like a connection, but it's telling me more about the components of the Riemann tensor that are sort of occur in free field. So they're like components of the Weyl tensor. This bit is what's contributing to the real physical Ricci space-time curvature, and it's the background, so that's kind of familiar. But notice the other part is like FF. So our space-time curvature is not just coming from the curvature of the geometry, but it's coming from things that look like the field strength of that cross term A. It's possible. I think it did say omega C, omega D. It does look like it should be a plus, doesn't it? Yeah. Don't swear my eyes are eagle-eyed. Yeah, it probably is a plus. It looks like it should be a plus, doesn't it? Yeah, we'll stick with a plus. So the final bit that we need is relatively easy in comparison. So essentially, when I take a derivative of my theta psi a, my one forms associated with the extra dimension, I've got quite a lot of differentiation to do. So, you know, I've got a second derivative of the scalar. I've got yet another derivative of omega psi, which gives me sort of, you know, more derivatives of my scalar. I get yet another component of f. And with apologies for microscopic writing. Actually, no, take a look on the other. So I think I was once asked something like, you know, about, I think, off-diagonal terms in the Riemann tensor. How did you know you picked them all out? So here, there's a sort of sense in which things ought to be consistent for these, you know, A, B, C, psi pieces. And so you can see that there are terms coming up that have a partial derivative of sigma and the F. There's also, you can see there's an f theta naught term there, and also an f a b comma c. So you can kind of see that these cross terms are appearing on both sides, but all that we really need is the piece that's going to contribute to the Ricci tensor. So if I kind of look in here, what that means is I need things that have a B cross a psi in them. Actually, I think that should have been a psi. See the Monday morning effect again. So that's that term. That term, I can see one sitting here. I can see one sitting there. And none of those. So if I look at those, I've got an FF piece again, and then I've got a second derivative of sigma, and this is just the connection term that I need to turn that into a covariant derivative. So putting all that together, I can extract what my Ricci tensor is and therefore what the Ricci scalar is. So pulling all those pieces together, you see that what we've managed to do is we've expressed our five-dimensional Ricci scalar as the four-dimensional Ricci scalar of our four-dimensional metric plus an F-squared piece And then finally, an extra term involving derivatives of that scalar field. So things that contribute to the fact that it contains the curvature of that four-dimensional metric g hat shouldn't really be a surprise because we're calculating a curvature of a manifold. The fact that it contains derivatives of sigma shouldn't be a surprise because this is like an extra dimension, a circle. It could get bigger, it could get smaller as we wander throughout our four-dimensional manifold. So we expect something in there telling us about the change of our scalar field. What's perhaps a little bit more surprising is that by parameterizing our off-diagonal terms, the space-time psi pieces of the metric, with our one form, we've ended up with a field strength. So this was really what I think Kaluza was kind of excited about when he first noticed this. So he sent his paper off to, these were the days before the archive, he sent his paper off to Einstein, who then kind of sat on it for ages, not because he was being mean or anything. I think he was just trying to sort of figure out whether, you know, first of all, in those days, it was, is this right? But then, you know, I think just trying to understand, was this actually something, you know, that could be important? And then he decided, yes, he kind of liked it. So, so we've also, I think I, did I write it down? I can't remember whether I wrote down root g. I think I did, yes. E to the sigma root g, write it down again. So what that means is if I look at my five-dimensional Einstein action, which is simply integral of r root g, then I get So this, the reason why I wrote my derivative of the scalar field in that format is because once I multiply by root g5, I get an e to the sigma that cancels off that prefactor of e to the minus sigma. So the scalar term is just a total derivative, and all I end up with is what looks like Einstein-Maxwell theory, sort of. So this was really why Kaluza was so excited. It's because adding one extra dimension to space-time suddenly seemed to give you electromagnetism. So, you know, that was somewhat unexpected and, you know, quite exciting as a result. It'd be really nice, you know, to get a result like that. So, but is it really Einstein-Maxwell theory? And what's happened to the scalar? We've lost our, you know, we don't have a kinematic term for the scalar, so how do we describe the dynamics of the scalar? So this is, this sort of takes us to the second piece that of information that I wanted to talk about today, which is talking about not just the fact this is not quite Einstein gravity, but different ways that we can look at our Lagrangian degrees of freedom. So the reason this is not Einstein gravity is that our action or Lagrangian is really e to the sigma r hat. So what that means is we don't have, our action is not r over 16 pi g, it's r times something variable over 16 pi g. So in a sense, if I just, without, you know, doing any work, just sort of looking at it and thinking about it, if that is my five-dimensional action, nothing depends on psi, so actually this would be an integral. It's not a good one, call it L. Nothing depends on psi. When I integrate over the psi direction, I just get a length, whatever the length of the circle is that the extra dimension has. So what that means is from a four-dimensional perspective, I'm getting L, which I need because G5 has dimensions L cubed. My Newton's constants have dimensions L squared. So this means my effective Newton's constant is actually G5 e to the sigma over L. So it's actually not a constant. It's something that could be dependent on where we are in space. So this is known as scalar tensor gravity. And it was investigated by Brands and Dickey in the early 60s, and Jordan, I guess, from a different perspective in the 50s. So the idea is you've still got something that's like Einstein gravity. It still has a tensor mode coming from the Ricci scalar, but it's also got a scalar degree of freedom. So it is different in nature. So one reason, some people, I guess it's a matter of taste, some people don't like to have to work in a frame in which you have gravity not being like Einstein gravity. So what do we mean? Wouldn't it be nice if we could do some sort of transformation on our system so that our gravity looks normal, looks like Einstein gravity? So to do this, what we need to do is rescale our distances. So this means we need to do a conformal transformation. So this is conformal in the sense of gravity rather than CFT. So what we're going to do is we're going to write our four-dimensional metric as a factor, some scale factor, times a new four-dimensional metric. So omega here is just a rescaling. This does not change angles, because angles are like, you know, cos theta is a dot b over mod a mod b, so any rescalings cancel out. It just changes distances. So what we're saying is, let's consider rescaling our distance function, but not just rescaling it by choosing a different ruler, so it's not a global rescaling. We're going to rescale our space sort of in a different way in different places. So it's a different weighting function, omega, in different places on the manifold. So this, if we calculate what this does to the connection, and then follow it through to what it does to the curvature, which I think there might be a tutorial question on that. I'm not quite sure. So then the reason that we're doing this rescaling is if we change our notion of length, we change our curvature. We can kind of see that because the dimensions of curvature are L to the minus 2. So if we change our, you know, if we just globally rescaled length, we would change the curvature tensor by 1 over that rescaling squared. Mm-hmm.
This looks a little bit like a gauge transformation. I mean, it's a gauge, a scale transformation, or dilation. Is it related to this?
It's not a gauge transformation from the, you know, a gravitational sense, in that, you know, gravitationally our observable is distance. So if we start sort of mushing it around, and, you know, and sort of, you know, making our sigma definitely has a physical meaning. So sigma is telling you about the size of the circle, which is something real.
Well,
we can't see the circle, but we can see the scalar. So, yeah, I mean, I'll kind of try and come back to some of these themes, yeah, as we go on.
This transformation isn't like a physical one, right? It's not like you're doing like a change of coordinates or anything like that.
No, it's what we call a change of frame. So we are, let me just put some of these words down. It's a change of frame, and we say the original frame is called the Jordan frame, because it must have been Jordan who was kind of thinking about these conformal transformations in the context of gravity or geometry. And then our new frame that I'm about to define is called the Einstein frame. So the Einstein frame is the one in which our gravitational action looks like the Einstein action. So it's not, you know what?
No, it's just like, for example, I was thinking like cosmology, for example, where you have like a Roberts-Walker metric,
mm-hmm.
and like you put in conformal time, and then you have like an overall a squared factor.
Yes.
This basically like would kill off that factor in this case, right? And you would have like a Minkowski space.
What would look like flat space.
Right.
But if you do that, if you did that transformation, you're already in the Einstein frame when you're doing cosmology. So if you then try to do a transformation, you go away from the Einstein frame. So your gravity would no longer be Einstein gravity. So you wouldn't be able to make the usual deductions that you intuitively make about, oh, you know, this is flat, so there's no gravity or whatever. So it's, I think it's because, so we develop intuition based on our experience with looking at different systems. And some of the intuition we have with geometry is inherited from it being an Einstein-Hilbert action. And so, you know, it's dependent on whether you would like to keep gravity following a certain set of rules at the expense of other things changing, or would you like to keep your other interactions following the same set of rules at the expense of gravity doing something funny? Because if you change things like distances, if, you know, I mean, here I'm just saying that this, I'm really just looking at gravity, so you're not seeing the price that's being paid. But of course, in my Lagrangian for the scalar, for example, you know, my d phi squared right here, my root g d phi squared is, or g hat, so my root g hat goes like omega to the fourth root g, and then this d phi squared has a g inverse in it, so then I'm going to get an omega to the minus 2 g mu d mu phi d nu phi. So my kinetic term for my scalar is now not pretty. My scalar field has a coupling to this gravitational scalar through its kinetic term. And so if you do a conformal transformation, what's going to happen in terms of normal particle interactions is things like, your definition of time, if you define time via atomic clocks, not via some sort of abstract thing associated with the manifold, that's going to change because you've done this conformal transformation. It could change, you know, depending on where you put your clock in the universe or when you are in the universe. So it's a matter of choice. But from a, you know, it depends on the problem, but this can be an effective tool, changing your frame, depending on what questions you need to answer. So if I choose, omega to be e to the minus sigma on 2, then I see that I've got an omega to the minus 2 coming from going from r hat to r, and then I've got an omega to the 4 acting on my root g. So overall, I pull out a factor of e to the minus sigma with that choice, which is then going to cancel off the e to the sigma that I had in my original action. Finally, I'm just going to rescale my scalar field. So now I've got my Einstein action. I've just got r root g. I've now recovered a kinetic term for my scalar field, and that's the reason for rescaling it, so that it's a canonical kinetic term, a half grad phi squared, and now I've got f squared. So this is really giving you a much better feel for the degrees of freedom of Kaluza-Klein theory. Gravity in this frame is the normal spin 2 mode. I've also got a scalar field that's telling me about this sort of breathing mode, the size of my inner circle. And finally, I've got almost electromagnetism. Not quite. It couples to the scalar, but at least I can see that I do have a U1 gauge field in this case. So here I've got a proper, if you like, it's much easier for me to directly read off what my physical degrees of freedom are. So I do kind of get the degrees of freedom that I expect. So what happens now, to sort of come to the third part, what happens if I try and think about things like black holes? What I've got is I've got a normal kind of gravity interaction. I have now a charge, so I can charge up my black hole. You've seen normal Einstein charged black holes, the Riesman and Nordström solutions. So here, presumably, I get a Riesman and Nordström type of solution. And then I've got this scalar field, which may or may not come in to play. We have to just see.
Question?
Mm-hmm.
Curvature that's now in the action, is that the one associated with the old frame?
No, so I've tried, I think I've tr- try to hat all the R's that were associated with the original G hat, the original four-dimensional, you know, when I wrote my, perhaps if, let me just write down, I think I've got it somewhere, what my five-dimensional metric is here with respect to these variables. So it's this one, which has the scale.
The coordinates we're integrating the Lagrangian over are not the same that are used to define the curvature and the square root of the metric. Isn't that a problem?
Yes, they are. They're these coordinates here, and it's this piece. It's this. This is our d4x. And this is our G, yeah. It's not dissimilar to when we were thinking of the domain wall, except there our prefactor depended on the extra dimension. So there's analogies and differences to things that we've already seen.
So say I live in this four-dimensional subspace,
yeah,
and I don't care about electromagnetism, I just do like geometric measurements of the space, then this R that we get in this action is the natural one I will find, which is
the natural one. Ooh, that's so dependent, isn't it? I would actually say not, because I think that, you know, the way we perceive the world is based on, you know, our sort of standard particle interactions. So I would say the frame in which those look natural is sort of how we would perceive the world, because that's how we would measure distances, in which case our gravity would be more like the Jordan frame. But, you know, it's sometimes easier. I'm simply presenting this, right, as a choice of frame, that it is sometimes easier to go to an Einstein frame, because then, if you like, I guess what I'm about to do is, I'm probably doing a bit of a combination of both frames when I talk about black holes, but sometimes if you've gone to the Einstein frame, you maybe can just, you know, kind of look up in a book quickly, oh, here's, you know, here's my tensor, here's what I'm looking at, I just pop in my energy momentum tensor, on the other side I've got a solution. Now, interpreting the solution, you might want to step back and think of the fact that you've got the other frames, but often by going to the Einstein frame, you can lean on things you've already got.
So in this sense, I will, rather than just seeing a varying, like, say, electromagnetic coupling constant, I will still see this changing effect of Newtonian constant, like as a scalar, or if it was like an actual observer in the system.
No, in the Einstein frame, you have a constant, Newton's constant.
Yeah.
But you've got an explicit scalar degree of freedom there. In the Jordan frame, you might prefer to say you've got a varying Newton's constant rather than a scalar degree of freedom. It's the same. I think we better talk about the philosophy afterwards. I mean, clearly the underlying physics, you know, of what's going on should be the same, irrespective of the way you choose to describe it. But it's the way you choose to describe it may have different words and different meanings associated with it. So the first thing I just want to note, I said that the extra dimension is associated with electric charge, but it's a little more than that. Once we compactify, once we say psi is circular, we've actually picked a rest frame as far as psi is concerned, because my circular identification of psi says I identify psi with psi plus L at a fixed time. So if I make a boost in my sort of T psi space before I do an identification, then that is a different space-time. So if I look at this boosted frame, T prime psi prime, if you like, this point is identified with that point, and that is not at the same T primed, okay? So when we go to, when we look in a boosted frame, our T, we don't just identify one coordinate with one coordinate plus a bit. We've actually got to identify the points T prime psi prime with the point T prime minus V gamma L and psi prime plus gamma L. So the plus gamma L is not a surprise because we've kind of got the length contraction, but we've got to remember that our coordinate system has changed. So this means that motion in the psi direction is actually associated with something physical. And so we would expect that we get charged black holes. So I'm just simply going to construct one for you by taking the Schwarzschild solution, the black string, and before making the identification, I do a Lorentz boost. So that means that I replace in my black string solution, I'm replacing T and psi with their boosted versions. So if I multiply that out, so I've specifically multiplied it out so that it looks like the format that we were using for the Kaluza-Klein metric. I've peeled off a four-dimensional geometry, that's this first bit, and then I've completed the square for the psi direction, which is the second bit. So that means I can read off what my gauge field is and what my scalar field is for this particular geometry. So normally you would expect in gravity that a Lorentz boost would not change your physical space-time, but here it does because the extra dimension is identified periodically. So this solution is indeed physically distinct. So if I just sort of rewrite my coordinates sort of in a fairly obvious way, I want to be able to have something that looks a bit like 2GM on R there. Then my gauge potential now looks like a normal gauge potential for a charge. My scalar field also has some non-trivial dependence. Okay. Sorry, that should just be M there. So if I just, I've just sort of, you know, redefined a couple of things, you see that there's aspects of this that look similar to Schwarzschild, except why should it look similar to Schwarzschild? Because now we've got a charge. And there's aspects of this that look a bit different. So notice that we're not in the area gauge, because we've multiplied by this function here. We've got two potentials. So it's like Reisner-Nordström in the sense of we get an extra root coming from a charge. But now they're doing something quite different, because here we've got 1/√ of this. So you can see that there's some aspects that are similar and some aspects that are different to the Reisner-Nordström solution. So what's causing the differences? If I look here at, you know, what the action is doing, one thing that's different is the scalar field is multiplying F. So if I have a charge, if I think about what's happening from the interactions, if I have a charge, then I have to have a varying scalar field. If I have a varying scalar field, I now have more energy momentum sitting outside the black hole. So I'm no longer in this same sort of special setup that I had with Reisner-Nordström. So I do expect to have more things going on in the metric because of that scalar field changing as I go throughout the space-time. On the other hand, I still sort of expect 1/r potentials, because I'm still dealing with gravity, which, you know, again, a mass point mass source should have an m/r piece in it. So this also, like Reisner-Nordström, has an extremal limit. Which is a little strange from the background solution. In this extremal limit, what you do is you speed up the boost to the speed of light and let your original black hole mass drop. So you take this simultaneous limit. It's a massless particle boosted to the speed of light. So normally, if you set to m to 0, you'd expect, you know, the black hole to go away. But here, it doesn't. And you do it in such a way that this m hat remains constant. And that is actually an extremely electric charged Kaluza-Klein black hole, but it's singular. I don't think I've really got time to do the magnetic black hole, but just to sort of wrap up, what this tells you with extra dimensions is that you can have charged black holes because you've got higher dimensional charges. So I mentioned that last week. You can have charged black holes because you have the extra degrees of freedom. You can make a boost along one of the Killing vector directions, and that also gives you a charged black hole. So black hole or black brain solutions in higher dimensions have a lot more degrees of freedom and a lot more things that can go on. You've got higher dimensional charges. You've got these boosts along the extra dimensions. And finally, just to note, everything I've done here is with one extra dimension, but you can have more than one extra dimension, obviously. And then what changes is that you assume that your extra dimensions, the geometry doesn't depend on them. So then you get a gauge field for every killing vector associated with the extra dimensions. So if they were just like a torus, you would just have a little gauge direction for the different directions of the torus. If you had like a two-sphere, you've now got three killing vectors because it's got SO3 symmetry. And then you could get a non-abelian gauge field coming from that extra symmetry group. So, you know, there's below Kaluza and Klein initially just did this for one extra dimension, dependent on the geometry of your extra dimensions and the various different geometrical invariants that you can have sitting inside this little space that we don't directly see. You can get quite a complex structure of low energy excitations, because what we're seeing, if we see the gauge field, we're seeing something that's effectively motion in the extra dimension. When we see the scalar, we're seeing things that are rescaling internal dimensions. So it's not that the internal dimensions leave no imprint at all on our normal space-time, you know, four-dimensional world. It's just that we don't see them directly. So.
So the topology of the internal space is related to the gauge group of the gauge sector of our theory?
Yeah, it's more, it's I guess more the geometry of the internal space, in the sense that, you know, what symmetries does it have, you know, how simple is it? If it's not Ricci flat, I mean, if it's not Ricci flat, then you pick up, as we can sort of guess from what we did last Friday with this sort of building block structure, you're going to pick up like sort of cosmological constant terms as well in the action. So again, you know, there's a lot of extra things that can feed back into the four-dimensional world depending on what's happening in the internal space. So, yep.
If you go back to the action in the isoframe, mm-hmm. and you try to recover a four-dimensional Hilbert plus electromagnetism terms, mm-hmm. then phi has to be constant, right?
So that was actually what I think was it Klein who, you know, sort of said, suppose we just fix that scalar, yeah.
But then the potential that you have for phi is basically an exponential. So isn't it like unstable?
So it depends which solutions you're looking at. I mean, one of the reasons why I think the Kaluza-Klein was sort of for so long relegated to a curiosity, that's not true. I think people would be very resistant to having extra dimensions, and people didn't care to a large extent about general relativity for a long time. But mostly it's the fact that you've got to be very careful with these scalar degrees of freedom, because cosmologically, when you look at what couples to my scalar degree of freedom, here it's just electromagnetism. In general, you've got all sorts of matter, and that will couple to the scalar field. From a cosmological perspective, you find these extra degrees of freedom either open up the extra dimensions and so destroy a four-dimensional universe, or they drive you very rapidly towards a singular behavior where the extra dimensions crunch up. So we've always regarded these massless degrees of freedom as a problem. This is called the moduli problem. And so when we do have extra dimensions, one of the things that people get very concerned about is trying to stabilize them so that they don't run off. And of course, if they're stabilized, you have the extra bonus that no longer do they give you a changing Newton's constant. So, should we let the guy clean the boards?